This is Smart Women, Smart Power, a podcast that features conversations with some of the world's most powerful women.
So the first time I really thought about breaking the glass ceiling was when I stood in front of the Sandia workforce the day of the announcement of my selection as the laboratory director.
We feature women who are breaking barriers and shaping the future of foreign policy, national security, international business, and development. I'm Beverly Kirk, the director of the Smart Women, Smart Power Initiative at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. The number of women in STEM fields is small. The number of women working on technical nuclear issues is even smaller. I sat down with two trailblazers in this area for our Smart Women Pony Pathbreakers series. Dr. Marina Robinson Snowden is a senior engineer in the National Security Analysis Department at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab and a former National Nuclear Security Administration graduate fellow in the Office of Major Modernization Programs. Jill Harubi was the Nuclear Threat Initiative's inaugural Sam Nunn Distinguished Fellow and is the former director of Sandia National Laboratories. We discuss their groundbreaking careers and the future of nuclear proliferation. Marina and Jill, thanks so much for joining me here on the Smart Women, Smart Power podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks, Bev.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with each of you telling me how you got started in the nuclear technology space. Jill, why don't we start with you?
Okay. Well, I would say my journey was actually a bit through the back door. I really made a decision to work at a national laboratory, not necessarily to work in nuclear technology, because I liked the idea of doing science-based engineering, and I really liked the idea of working on hard problems of national importance. So when I started at Sandia, I worked in both renewable energy and nuclear weapon thermal analysis. But in the Reagan administration, just after I started, there was an increase in funding for nuclear weapons and a decrease in funding for renewable energy. So I was asked to shift my emphasis to weapons work. I found the work really technically interesting and challenging, and I was mostly very pleasantly surprised by the attitude of the people who supported the weapons program. They were thorough, careful, and respectful of the solemn importance of the nuclear weapons mission. But throughout my career, I worked on nuclear weapons some of the time and other national security issues other times. And as I progressed through my career, I guess I better understood the connection between different kinds of national security issues.
And Marina, how about you?
Sure, yeah. So my introduction to the nuclear technology space was really coming from physics. So I was a physics undergraduate at Florida A&M University in Tallahassee. And I was looking for, you know, what my next step was going to be by way of graduate school. And, you know, you go through the whole process, you apply to a bunch of schools and cast a broad net. And nuclear engineering was the only program that accepted me, nuclear engineering at MIT. So that kind of set my course, you know, in terms of the cards that I was dealt. But once I got into the program, it was around the time that the JCPOA talks were just starting to happen. You know, it was when the IAEA had released their first report on Iranian noncompliance. And that was kind of what was in the news at the time. And I found that conversation really interesting. So I started out in nuclear engineering as a plasma physics student, but then quickly shifted to a program that we have called Nuclear Science and Technology, which allowed me to start investigating more arms control and nonproliferation type questions, but from a technical perspective. So my interest was really in radiation detection and measurement. How can we use radiation detectors to monitor and verify arms control agreements between nuclear weapon states? And that was the topic of my thesis. And that really set the course for all the other professional experiences I've had to date.
And I want to follow up with both of you on the fact that you are in deeply entrenched in STEM, in a STEM field. And I want to talk about women and girls in STEM. But first, I want to follow up on your individual experiences. First, for Marina, your PhD is in nuclear engineering from MIT. You are the first Black woman nuclear engineer to get this degree at MIT. What were some of the challenges that you faced? Did you set out to be a pathbreaker, or was this just your passion?
It's such a funny question. You know, I don't think anybody sets out to be a pathbreaker in that way. It definitely wasn't my intention. You know, I was just trying to find the next opportunity, you know, and that's kind of been my approach ever since then. When I got into MIT, you know, MIT is a challenging place generally for every single person that's there, right? They demand the highest level work ethic of focus and discipline. But beyond that, particularly for my experience, you know, it was interesting coming from a historically Black college where the majority of the students are of African descent, and then going to a place like MIT, which is a predominantly white institution, right? And I understood, I guess, theoretically that that would be difficult, but it was really the practical challenges of being either the only woman or the only person of color, oftentimes the only Black person in a room, and just kind of, at least initially, being really hypersensitive about the things that made me unique, whether it was, you know, how I pronounce certain words or the slang that I use or the way that I wear my hair. It just was more of a focus of the conversation than it was when I was at Florida A&M. And I had to learn to get comfortable with myself again, right? To be confident about what makes me me, and then really try to find community outside of my department with other folks who are walking a similar path. Because unfortunately, you know, the situation in STEM still is the case that people of color are severely underrepresented, particularly on the domestic side in these different programs.
And if I could follow up on that point, young women of color who may be listening to this podcast and hearing you speak about what you have accomplished, what advice do you have for them if they too are interested in a STEM subject and want to pursue hard science?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, I think it's two things. The first thing is trust your gut, right? If you have any inclination towards a STEM field, even a passing interest, don't dismiss that, right? Because I had no idea that I would be here. I applied to Florida A&M to be a lawyer. I mean, a business person. I applied to the business program, right? So be open to the possibility of you being interested in something different. But then also as a tactic, you know, you have to find folks that you feel comfortable letting down the mask, you know, and we often talk about code switching and the duality of being a person of color in America. And it's a really exhausting walk to feel like you have to mold yourself. And it's important to find folks that you feel like you can be your genuine self with. And that in turn builds the confidence to be genuine in every space, right? But I think it's easier said than done to say, oh yeah, just be yourself and be comfortable. I mean, it's not always the easiest thing to do in practice. So I think it's about trying and trying again with the supportive community to kind of be who you are.
And Jill, you were the first woman to head one of our national weapons laboratories, Sandia. That had to be a really interesting and perhaps difficult path to reach that level of acclaim. Can you talk a bit about what it was like to crack that glass ceiling?
Yeah, well, interesting. You know, the interview process to become a lab director is, well, let's say a bit grueling and certainly thorough. And in my mind, when I was being interviewed for the lab director position after a long career, after a 30-year career at Sandia, I never thought about being a woman as being an element of my being considered for that position. So I really didn't think about breaking the glass ceiling. And I'm actually glad I didn't, because it probably would have put pressure on me in a way that turned out not to be true. So to continue the story, so the first time I really thought about breaking the glass ceiling was when I stood in front of the Sandia workforce the day of the announcement of my selection as the laboratory director. And there was so much sort of energy and joy in the audience that I felt that while I hadn't intended to talk about sort of breaking the glass ceiling, I ended up just from the energy saying, and isn't it great that our laboratory was the first laboratory to have a woman? And people jumped to their feet and applauded. And it was just such an amazing feeling. I mean, it wasn't just the women, it was the men and the women in the audience who, in fact, felt this pride in that, in the selection and breaking the ceiling from within our institution. And of course, this was followed by lots of email messages from all over the country and frankly, the world about, you know, people who knew me mostly, but some people who didn't know me saying how glad they were that we had crossed this threshold in the United States and our nuclear weapons laboratory. So, and then I felt just sort of, there was so much positivity and so much energy around it that while there would be people waiting for me to make a mistake, because that always happens when you're the first person to do something, there were also so many people who were on my side that it didn't feel like a particular weight once I sort of realized how important it was.
You both have mentioned the fact of being the first to accomplish something incredibly great. And talk a little bit more about being the first and that pressure that you mentioned, Jill, of being in that position. Maybe you didn't think about it at the time, but was there ever a point where you really did feel as you got into the job that, oh, if I make a mistake, I'm the first in this job. Will this close the door behind me for other women? And Marina, I'd also like to get your thoughts on being the first, as you were at MIT in the PhD program.
Well, I would say, you know, from my perspective, throughout my career, I felt that. I felt it honestly more as I started my career, that there weren't very many women at the laboratory, and that it felt like people were watching pretty carefully about what this meant and how were we as good as they were. And building technical, I always call it technical street cred, ended up being, you know, just very much at the front of my mind at all times. But as time went on, while that was always around, I also was much more confident in, well, one, my track record of success, and two, just in myself, that I knew what I was doing, and we all make mistakes, and I learned, you know, quickly to admit any mistake I made and to not let it, you know, play mind games with me, and just to get on with things. And so the truth is, that time helped, and by the time I became the lab director, I was a well-known quantity in the circles that I worked in and in the laboratory, and I wasn't so concerned about making mistakes, but I was very careful about admitting mistakes very quickly so that people understood I knew that was a mistake and I'm human too.
Marina?
You know, I just feel so fortunate to be on this call because I just feel like Jill is giving me so much wisdom because I am in very much the position that she described earlier in her career. You know, I do completely agree that I feel like experience in the field breeds confidence, you know, and, you know, there is a level of pressure, I mean, coming internally and externally, right? Like there's name for these things, right? Stereotype threat, the idea that if you drop the ball, this is somehow a mark on your entire culture or gender or things like that. And I've been fortunate enough to be exposed to these theories and these concepts. So it's given me strength in knowing that like I'm not alone in those thoughts. I think it's also interesting when you become the first of anything, there's also an added level of pressure because a lot of people have a lot of ideas about how you should use that accomplishment or how you should use that space and what you mean to the culture or what you mean to the field, right? And for me, it's been really important, particularly in these earlier professional years. You know, I'm charting my course right now. I'm trying to figure out what I want to do. I mean, I know that it's never linear and you can never, you know, predict exactly where you're going to end up, but really trying to be conscious of what my vision for myself is versus everyone else's vision, right? Because I'm getting a lot of advice, some of it amazing, some of it not so amazing, right? And being able to filter out the pushes and pulls that I feel from the nuclear security space to figure out what makes me happy from a technical perspective. And also, like exactly like Jill mentioned, you know, understanding that, or at least being able to acknowledge what I've done so far, right? And not getting caught up in this idea that I have to continue to prove myself and prove myself, which is often the mindset that, you know, underrepresented folks in STEM feel because that's what the environment demands of them, or the feeling of the environment, right? That at each new step, you have to reprove your bona fides. And I'm trying every day not to buy into that, right? Like understanding that I do bring a lot to the table, to Jill's point, and demonstrating a track record of success and using that as, you know, the foundation foundation of my confidence going into every professional engagement.
Well, let's talk about women and girls in STEM and nuclear science and engineering in particular. What will it take to get more women into this field? Is it a matter of just starting early? Both of you have described how your career evolved into this field. It was what you're doing now isn't exactly what you started out at the beginning. So how do you encourage more young women, young girls to be interested in this field?
I can take a stab at that first, if you don't mind. I think for me, I look at the representation question in STEM on from two different perspectives. I think there's two different efforts we have to attack. The first is recruitment. And I feel like we've made a lot of progress on, you know, trying to rework the narrative or reimagine who STEM spaces belong to, right? We have a lot of initiatives and efforts focused on bringing young women and girls into the space, convincing them, right, that this is a space for them. Where I feel like we need additional effort and investment is on the second piece of retention. Right? Because the problem, it's a misrepresentation to say that the problem is strictly about getting women into these spaces. Like once we get them through the door, we can all sing kumbaya. Like that's just not the reality of the situation. The other side of the story is that once you get these very talented and qualified women into the space, what type of space are they encountering? Right? Is the culture one that fosters excellence or is it one that drives them out because of different types of pressures? Right? And that's a lot more difficult conversations for institutions to have because it requires reflection on your own policies and practices, right? What are you doing to your own employees that either fosters success or pushes them out of the field? And I can see seeds of that conversation happening, starting to happen in the nuclear security space, but we are by no means as far along in the retention conversation as we are in the recruitment.
Jill?
Yeah, I really agree with Marina on all and everything she said here. I do think that we've done a lot better on recruitment. I still worry because I still talk to so many young people in the field, young women in the field, who are there by a series of coincidences. And I think we just can never get, you know, my goal is 50% women. I mean, why not? And I don't know how we ever get anywhere close to that if it takes this. I met this faculty member I really liked, or I happened to have a conversation with and thought this might be interesting and took one class. I mean, I hear a lot of stories like that. So I think recruitment is better, but we really need to keep at it for the long run. And I think we're doing better with women in this regard than we are, you know, in the race battle. So we really need to figure out what we've learned that's worked right and how it would translate or if it will translate to getting more underrepresented people into the field. With respect to keeping them, I think there's just so much happening in the workforce right now in every regard. I mean, there's been so many movements and so many things happening and changes, and especially, you know, pre-COVID when recruiting was very hard, that we're trying to do a lot of things at once in institutions to recruit and keep the right people. And it does, I am completely with Marina that it requires like every single person in a workplace to recognize what his or her behavior, you know, how that influences other people. And we nobody wants to take the time to do that. I mean, STEM people want to work on, they just want to get to work. And so convincing them that their work could be better and the institution's work could be better if they took a pause and a time out from their work and explored behaviors. And that needs to be done. And it's a truly difficult challenge.
It is indeed a challenge. I do actually want to, before we run out of time, ask you about some specific issues in the nuclear area. And I have to ask you both, given the tenor of the world today, what worries you most about nuclear proliferation, particularly the role of non-state actors? And what worries you about the world we live in right now?
Maybe I'll start, Marina, and you can pile on or add your thoughts. With respect to nuclear proliferation, there's a lot to worry about. Today, you know, our focus is really on emerging powers and a few nuclear proliferance states that we're worried about, North Korea and Iran, less non-state actors. So I think we really worried about non-state actors after 9/11. We continue to worry about that, but it's kind of taken a back seat, and finding the right balance will be complicated. But the truth is, the U.S. relationship with Russia and China right now, to me, is the most worrisome, not in terms of proliferation per se, but making sure that our nuclear policies are understood by each other, that they're, you know, they provide stability, and not using new technology, and there's lots of new technology available, to in fact begin to accelerate and re-enter a nuclear arms racing period. So I'm spending my time worrying about that problem right now more than any other.
Marina?
No, I completely agree with Jill. You know, we are in a different world. You know, Obama released his nuclear posture review in 2010, where he, you know, prioritized the question of proliferation to non-state actors. And we saw, you know, the nuclear security summits come out of that. But then you look at this administration's nuclear posture review that was done in 2018, and they had a very different view on what the world looked like, right? And this resurgence of what they call great power competition. And for me, I think it's really interesting to ask the question, what will the world look like post the 2020 U.S. election, right? I think this is going to set the course in one way or another with respect specifically to our allies and ally cohesion, right? One of the things that we don't really spend a lot of time thinking about is, you know, the role that our extended deterrence posture has played in the question of non-proliferation, right? There's NATO countries that have decided not to pursue their own nuclear deterrent because of the shield provided by the U.S. nuclear deterrent. And the question about how the current administration sees their NATO responsibilities, it was a very active conversation in 2018. And I think, you know, it's still on the table. Our European allies are, I guess, you know, quite nervous is the word I would use about, you know, what their stability or what the stability of the region looks like in the next 4 to 8 years. And this question of, you know, are the courses that we've been set on under this administration going to be sustained moving forward, or will there be a U-turn, right? We've seen the JCPOA go by the wayside, the INF pillars of our arms control, you know, regime. And all of this ties into how Europeans and other allies, whether it's South Korea or Japan, think about their security, what security guarantees can they rely on? And given those questions, what do they need to do to ensure the security of their citizens? You know, so these are all questions that are very much in flux. It's not the traditional, you know, DPRK and Iran concern, because we're talking about countries that we have strong relationships with. But, you know, we are going to help to set a lot of their decisions in the way that the U.S., you know, plans to move going forward on these questions.
If I could follow up on a couple of things here. One, Jill mentioned the technological advances and the role that they may play in the nuclear question, both for our allies and for our adversaries. How concerned are you about what North Korea is doing, what Iran is doing, in the context of the renewed great power competition involving Russia, China, and the U.S.? And Marina, if you want to start with this one.
Sure. You know, I think that, you know, we had a period of, you know, whether it was cautious optimism or hope in the bilateral talks between the U.S. and the DPRK in, you know, 2018 and 2019. But we've seen that the situation has changed, right? And the DPRK has a different position with respect to continued talks with the U.S. They have, I think, tried to increase their leverage by, you know, series of missile launches and different activity that we've seen via satellite monitoring and things like that. And I think, you know, this just adds adds increased stress and tension on an already stressed and tense situation between the great powers, right? So we've seen proxy wars in the past. It was a well-used tactic or a frequently used tactic in the Cold War. And we're starting to see these political schisms now between, you know, China and the US or Russia and China and things like that. So, you know, it's this idea of regional conflict and the risk of regional conflict, I think, is as worrisome today as it was during the Cold War. And I don't think that we can, you know, take our eye off the ball in any respect relative to that.
Jill?
Yeah, let me just talk about Iran for a little bit since Marina covered North Korea well. I think, you know, this week, in fact, I think just yesterday, China and Iran announced a potential new partnership that involved trade and oil. And this is this was going to complicate things. I think that a lot of people in the nuclear nonproliferation area were hopeful that the JCPOA, the Iran agreement reached in the Obama administration, could be revived in the future. But this new agreement with China is an interesting twist, and it's at the moment hard to tell where that will go. Of course, that's also combined with a attack that has occurred within the last couple of weeks at one of the nuclear sites in Iran, at a centrifuge site. So there's a lot going on there. And I would just say at this very moment, it's kind of hard to tell whether there will ever be an opening or opening anytime soon for a new agreement, or how the different alliances are going to play out with Iran in the future. So I think that's very, very dynamic right now, and something that we all need to keep an eye on and be creative about. How can we find some stability there?
And can we trust the information that we're getting out of places such as Iran and North Korea and even China? Do we actually have a real sense of what's going on the ground in these places so that we can judge what type of actions that we might want to pursue?
That's a hard question, and it's a good question. And the answer is sort of. You know, I think we have to pay a lot of attention to how those countries talk about the conditions themselves, whether or not it's true. It's the way they're messaging it. And then we also have to make sure we have other ways to get information. And we have to be careful about our biases in judging the information that we get from them and from other sources, and try to get to the ground truth. And that's getting increasingly difficult everywhere. And I think we really just have to, well, this is the reason we need really good people in these fields that want to get to the truth, because it's getting harder and harder.
If I can just add a point to that, you know, I think the question of information is not only relevant when we're talking about, you know, aspirational emerging nuclear states. It's also relevant when we're talking about established nuclear states, right? And this is one of the reasons why the verification regimes currently under New START are so important, right? When you talk about the ability to get information, or you talk about the Open Skies Treaty, right? This idea that we would be able to fly over each other's nations to gather information ourselves on what the status of our military capabilities are, or using verification to, you know, verify the deployed status of nuclear weapons, right? All of this is information that the United States, both the, you know, the White House and the military and Congress use to make decisions. So this is why, you know, the risk of losing these agreements is so grave, because there's a loss of information, there's a loss of transparency and access. And that's information that we use for military planning, for investment, for understanding if we can or cannot trust the word of our adversaries. So, you know, when people try, I think, to talk about verification as purely of military or purely of arms control value, it's a short-sighted description, because of the way that we use the information that's garnered from the verification regimes in the decisions that we make from a number of different perspectives.
I could talk to you guys about this topic all day, but as we begin to wrap up here, I want to turn the conversation to the purpose of this series, which is connecting the established generation of women in the nuclear space with the next gen rising stars, so to speak. Are there generational differences in how, or do you see generational differences in how next gen folks are approaching these issues that we've discussed today? Jill, I'll start with you on that, and then Marina, if you could respond.
Oh, I think so. And I'm certainly grateful that there are generational differences. I think it's time and it will make a difference. And, you know, I think every generation brings something different, but I think this generation is bringing so many great things to this field. And I'm really pleased. I will say I'm super pleased by the number of young people involved in the United States. I mean, while it could be more, they're really very, very high quality people. And I would say also in other countries, because I work a lot with Russia and China, and I've noticed that they have very high quality young people involved in the field. So there's a couple of things about generations. One is I think the field is actually changing. So the field of nuclear involves more disciplines now than it used to. So it used to be physicists and engineers. And now I think it includes a lot of computer scientists and information scientists and other people who have, in fact, a different way of thinking and sort of a different educational track, which I think contributes. And then I also think the interpersonal dynamics and communication so different in this generation, and in many ways much more effective, as and in some ways also more efficient. And I think their voice is stronger than I would say I thought my generation's voice was. I think they're less likely to stay quiet through situations that need to be spoken about, and I'm grateful for that. I think they're really bringing a lot to the field.
Marina?
Sure, I absolutely agree with everything that Jill said. The one thing that I'll offer is, you know, what I'm observing from my peers in this generation is a sincere effort to really be intersectional in how we approach these issues and how we attack them. You know, one of the critiques of, you know, previous movements, whether it's the feminist movement, the civil rights movement, was that they weren't intersectional, whether by design or by, you know, not having the opportunity or the resources to do broader work. And you can see now that people are trying to link issues, right? Trying to figure out how issues are influenced by each other, whether you're talking about the links between climate change and nuclear weapons, or you're talking about the links between, you know, poverty and race, or sexuality, you know, LGBTQ rights and Black Lives Matter rights, right? So people are really trying to have a broader conversation and build coalitions around these issues. And you see evidence of that also in the policy space. You have emerging leaders and thinkers that are trying to connect the nuclear issue to a broader set of issues. You know, I read a really interesting piece recently about the connections between, you know, police militarization and the way we think about nuclear weapons, the way we think about force. And it's that type of thinking that I think will generate novel ideas and ways for us to use our limited resources efficiently to actually come up with solutions. And the second thing I want to highlight from this generation is the fact that we are trying not just to address the issues, but also to address the field itself, right? What are we doing to make sure that our field in this space is as inclusive as possible, right? Trying to attack kind of conventional wisdom about who is considered an expert, whose voice is legitimate in this space, right? There's a lot of literature being generated by really dynamic young professionals like myself who want to have a conversation about Black and Brown people and the history of their nuclear story in this space, right? First Nations folks and their history in the nuclear space and how we need to think about that in terms of the path forward. So I think these are unique attributes to this generation that, you know, tries to address the world as it is today and is really the hope that we have for some really novel and interesting ideas.
Marina Robinson-Snowden, Jill Harubi, Thank you so much for being here on the Smart Women, Smart Power podcast. What a great conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bev. It was fun.
Subscribe to the Smart Women, Smart Power podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to good content. Be sure to follow us on Twitter @SmartWomen, and I'm @BeverlyKirk. Thanks for listening. See you next time.